Hey, and welcome to the 6 Minute Mile podcast. I'm David LaValle, and today we're sharing a fascinating conversation we just had with Jason Jabut about running, business, and life. Jason is the Chief Operating Officer at Fleet Feet, one of the largest specialty run shop businesses in the United States. He's a very lucky man in the sense that he's been able to marry his personal passion for running with his professional life. Jason was a 357 miler in the Powerhouse Villanova program in college and turned pro after graduation. That's when he met his wife, Trish, while running together in a Nike project at Stanford. Trish was actually the first person in the family to work at Fleet Feet, where she did a custom shoe fitting for Jason that immediately improved his running. Shortly after that experience, Jason joined the company in 2006 and has been there ever since, eventually being promoted to COO in June 2021. We dive into the reasons why Fleet Feet has been able to thrive, growing 24% in the pandemic-challenged year of 2020. The company has a booming e-commerce business and nearly 200 brick-and-mortar locations around the country. Jason explains to us how Fleet Feet has been able to grow so rapidly while still preserving a local feel in each of its markets. Enjoy, and we'll see you out there. So today's guest is Jason Jabut, who is an accomplished executive in the endurance sports industry as Chief Operating Officer of Fleet Feet, but perhaps more interesting to a lot of our audience. Jason, you are also probably the fastest distance runner we've had on our podcast. You know, we're going to call you a better runner than Bill Rogers. How about that?
I don't know if I'm deserving of that, but different distance and discipline, I think.
I was trying to bait you into being immodest, but you're too good a guy. So, all right. So we'd love to hear a little of your background. What first got you into the sport? I know you grew up in a place that's awful cold and beautiful, but cold in Plattsburgh, New York, right on Lake Champlain. But we'd love to hear about your early days. What was your earliest introduction to the sport?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was sort of an accident, happy accident. You know, I grew up in, you know, in my town, it was like baseball, basketball, and football were the sports. And so I don't think I even knew running was a sport for a very long time. And I really had a hard time trying to make teams. You know, I was always kind of cut down to the lowest team that I could sort of qualify for, trying out for football teams and basketball teams and the like. And so running, you know, I was going into my freshman year in high school, and honestly, pretty girl I knew, she kind of mentioned it to me because I said, I don't want to play football. I don't know what I'm going to do. And she said, you should try out for the cross country team. And I had never even considered it. And so that was really the start, you know. And I remember walking up to, I lived right down the street from our high school. And I walked up to the school. It was like late summer, a little late signing up. And I showed up to the first day that I was there for practice. And the coach, she said, well, if you want to be on the varsity cross country team, here's the workout. And they're doing 800 meter repeats around a field. And she said, in New York State, you can do, it's called modified. It's like JV. And she said, if you want to be modified, then you do this workout. And the idea of being on varsity anything was very appealing to me. So I decided to do the 800 meter repeats. And I just remember the next day I could barely walk forward. My forward front moving muscles weren't working. And so I remember having to walk backward up the street to go to practice the next day. And so that was my start. I don't know why I showed up the second day. The first day was pretty hard.
So did you have any idea you had some okay slow twitch fibers in your legs at that point? Or you just thought, hey, I'll go out and give it a shot?
No, you know, all my early formative sort of experiences in athletics were, I just didn't think I was very good at anything. I remember trying to work really hard, again, try to make a team and getting overlooked by coaches, and just, you know, those were really my formative experiences. So I never thought at all that I was talented or had any sort of ability. So in a way that was actually really helpful because I was just like really hungry and wanted to, you know, knew I had to put in work to win, you know, anything. And I will share this, that first team, when I went up to the high school, I struggled a little bit during middle school. You know, I had gotten in and out of trouble. I was having a hard time. And so I didn't have a great reputation. And anybody who, you know, has participated in high school cross country knows those are sort of like, they're the good kids, you know, they've got the good grades. And and so I was not particularly welcome on the team. And so the first couple of weeks were rough. I remember getting taken out on runs, and it seemed like everybody's goal was just to drop me. You know, they take me out on these silly runs, and they would take off and I was left alone. I'd walk down the roads and a coach would come by in her car or on her bike and she'd say, "Hey, no walking." And I was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't even know, you know, what's going on. And so I would start hobbling forward again. And, I remember like our first really, really easy run before there was a race that the first race we were going to have, preseason race. And I didn't know what an easy run was. So I just went out and ran as hard as I did every other day. And I ended up running ahead of the rest of the guys on the team. And, you know, it's not like we were friends at the time. So they, you know, it was just, the whole thing was kind of funny, like looking back and trying to remember it all. But I remember taking off and beating everybody back on like this easy 3 mile run. And I got back and they all started making fun of me for, you know, taking it, you know, running so hard on an easy run. And so, yeah, those are my early experiences they were interesting, but I ended up having this sort of mixture of like, I didn't really understand what the pecking order should be on a cross country team. So, and in a way I didn't really respect anybody on the team either, because it was just back and forth. Like, they didn't really want me there. They were showing me that. And so I got really, really lucky. I ended up transferring to a different high school and new team, set sort of a second chance at life. And that was pretty amazing. But at the same time, because I didn't have any really understanding of the sport or the pecking order, like, I just ran as hard as I could every day. And so that almost defines my whole high school experience, was running hard a lot and trying to see where it would take me. But yeah, those early days, I did not know what was ahead.
Now, was running part of the calculation in switching high schools?
No, part of the calculation for switching high schools was really, I struggled in middle school, and I kind of came to this realization that I didn't know how I was going to make it, you know, in high school, if I didn't sort of switch out of that environment. It was interesting that I would even be aware of that at that age, but
yeah,
I kind of put that all together and begged my parents to let me transfer to, it was a local Catholic school. And, you know, I'm one of eight kids and we didn't have a lot of money, but somehow my parents were able to put it together. Coincidentally, the team, the school that I transferred to, they had a great cross country team, and the school I left, they had a great team. And I ended up being the fifth guy on the cross country team at the new school. And a lot of people in town thought I transferred for running, but you know, I didn't know then. And, so it was just an interesting sort of coincidence, but yeah, back then that was all the news, you know, was that I did it intentionally and that we knew, and maybe the coach recruited me, but none of that was real. It was just, you know, coincidence.
Now, do you think a little bit of this, you know, we'll say polite troublemaker background, has that helped you in business? And I want to come back to your running career, but just to fast forward a little bit, a lot of people would say, hey, independent thinkers, people who look at the world a little differently, maybe willing to break some rules here and there. Has that helped you in your business career?
Actually, I think it has, because really what it means is I just don't take a lot of things for granted. Yeah, I don't know if challenge is the right word, but I like to question and sort of like work through things on my own terms to understand them. And I think that's been very beneficial. Yeah, it depends on the situation. Sometimes I think it works out better for me and others than other times. But for the most part, it's been very helpful, I think.
And did your academics improve at the new school?
They did. Yeah, new lease on life.
Love it. Well, no, Villanova is a great school academically. I know that's where you wanted for college. So you must have done pretty well.
Yeah, new lease on life. I remember I joined like the student council and, you know, started participating in different clubs, like the Key Club and different things, and, you know, worked hard on my grades. And yeah, you know, and I didn't really, the college thing is interesting too, because again, you know, I was new to running and I didn't really realize that there was going to be a path or an opportunity to run in college. And that presented itself really towards like my junior year in high school when my time started to really improve. So, yeah, Villanova, that was a great experience. I've been fortunate. I had some great coaches. I had a great high school coach. I think at the time she might've been, her name is Gail Wilson. She might've been the most, you know, had the most wins in high school cross country of any coach in New York State. I think that's true. I don't know if it's still true, but it was true. I think it was true at the time. And then Marcus O'Sullivan at Villanova was a great coach as well. And then I had some other great coaches afterwards. So, that was, so I was very fortunate to have some great mentors and coaches help me along the way.
And were the Empire State Games still going back then?
They were. Yeah. I went one time. I think it was my sophomore year. So that's great. So you're familiar with that. Have you been? Do you know much about it?
No, I know friends who grew up in New York from a bunch of different sports who would always talk about that being a great experience. It's kind of like the Olympics for the state, more or less, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in the summertime. And so there's you have to try out, you know, there's some qualifying races. And then if you make it, I think you have to pretty much pay your own way. But when I went my sophomore year, it was held in Rochester, New York. And, you know, you end up staying in dorms with really people you compete against throughout the state. So I ended up, you know, guys that I'd run against in high school, we're shacking up in the dorms and running races. And it was great. I mean, it was a really great experience.
And was that a big recruiting event? So that's going into your junior year, is that, or I don't know, how did you get on the map of Villanova?
So, you know, running is interesting because if you run a fast time, it ends up you can get on the map.
Yeah.
And so I was fortunate. I ran some pretty quick times early on. So I was on the map. You know, you start getting these college letters at a pretty early age. And so my junior year, actually, there's a local coach who actually he retired from coaching, but he's still very involved in the sport. And he's going to all the races. And I think it was an indoor track meet. My junior year where I also did the high jump. I was like really into high jump for some reason. And I was one meet where I think I had a pretty good day and I ran like the 300 and I couldn't remember tell you my time. I think I ran a 420 mile and I'm at a high jump like 6'2". And he took that and he actually sent a letter to Marcus at Villanova on my behalf. I didn't even know. And so that was kind of, you know, and his name is Scott Woodward. And he passed away a few years ago, but he became a good friend. And so that was kind of how I ended up on the map of Villanova. And then Marcus, you know, started calling and, you know, I had a visit there and you know, the rest is history.
So was that about your best time in high school in that sort of 420 range or did that come down junior and senior year?
It came down a good bit. I ran 410 the mile my junior year in high school. Let's see if I can remember everything. My junior year, you know, went to the New York State track meet and I ran the mile. That was the first time I'd won a state title. I won the 1600, I ran 4:13. And that was like a qualifying time. At the time there was the outdoor sort of high school national meet and was held in Raleigh, North Carolina. And so I qualified for that meet with that time. And so I, you know, begged my parents and they agreed. And so we flew down to Raleigh and, it's kind of an interesting story. When we got here, I found out that I was maybe the top seed of the second heat. And I really wanted to get in the fast heat. And so I found the race director as a high school kid. I found the race director and I started talking to him. And I asked him, I said, hey, what would I need to do to get in the fast heat? And he's probably thinking, well, you needed to run faster to get in the fast heat.
Right.
And so I said, hey, if you put me in the fast heat, I guarantee you that I will get in the top six. And he must have liked that I took that, you know, that I was that headstrong. And so he agreed to it. And so in the meet, you know, I tried to make my own luck happen. And so I ended up finishing in sixth place, which at the time I think was like the last, I forget if you got a medal or if it was like an All-American sort of status. But so I was, I got that right in the home stretch. I think I had to pass a couple of guys to get it, but I felt vindicated afterward. And he seemed excited by the whole experience. So that was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. And do you remember, did you spaz out a little bit in that race? Did you take it out real fast to make good on your promise?
No, that's a great question, but I was always a sit and kicker. Like I didn't really start taking it out faster until later. Really probably not until, my senior year, I tried because I was trying to run faster times. And, but no, at that point I was sit and kick. And so I probably was close to last place with a lap to go. And then I would try to blast that last lap. So I was really happy though, to run that was when I ran 4:10, in the mile. And then, and in my senior year, I ran about the same time. Actually, I qualified again, but I had different ambitions. When I went back to that same meet, I thought, you know, this time I'm going to try to win. And I had some great workouts and some great races leading up to it. And I thought I had a real chance at winning. That wasn't in the cards that day. I think I did take the lead. Ryan Hall actually won that race.
All right, that's good. You know, that's a good tale forever. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And we finished. I ran maybe a couple tenths of a second faster than my previous best, but it was good.
Yeah. And then Villanova has such a great running tradition, and Marty Lacoury and Sidney Marie and Eamon Coughlin. And I mean, so it's just such a deep, rich history there. Was that, did you feel that running in that program?
Oh yeah. You can't escape it.
Yeah.
And so when you get there, when you take a tour, you know, if you get to take like a real track tour, like a running tour, first of all, there's like the 10 relays, like the wheels, you know, from winning all the different relays are down. Like, I bet the campus has changed quite a bit since the last time I was there. But when you go down like towards where the lockers and everything are, it's just, you go down these hallways and it's just an endless sea of all these Penn relay wheels that they had won over time. And, you know, you look at the times for all the people. I mean, to get on the board, like to get in like the top 10 of any of the times as a distance runner is almost impossible, because a lot of the times were, some of them were faster than like the American records when I was there. And so, yeah, what's funny is like when I was running even, you know, professionally after college, I would go back to Penn relays and go out with people. And, you know, even with a 357 mile to my credit, like I was a nobody to these guys. I mean, they'd all been like world champions, you know, 350 milers. And so you had to do a lot better than that to be, you know, to get recognized by the Villanova crew.
Yeah. But so so you mostly focused on the mile at Villanova?
Yeah, you know, as a middle distance runner, you end up being kind of a workhorse for college teams, right? You end up in a lot of relays, you run. And I kind of got, I ran a lot of 800s, and we had a really great DMR. We had a pretty deep distance crew. I was actually part of the first, I think, official recruiting class for Marcus O'Sullivan. It was right when he started coaching at Villanova, and he had recently retired from his professional racing career. There was a good group of guys that came in when I went in. I mean, we had, some of these guys had run in Olympic Games and stuff. And so, there was a few milers, like Ryan Hayden was from Canada and he was a sub 4 minute miler in high school. You know, we had a guy, Adrian Blanco from New Zealand, who's an incredible distance athlete, finished in the top 10 at NCAA cross country. I mean, we had and a lot of great talent, even local Pennsylvania talent that had come in. And so it was a great team. But yeah, I primarily ran 800 and a lot of 1500 meters and miles. And I didn't really go up from there. Like I didn't really run 3K. I didn't run the 5K. I was kind of focused in those two events primarily, but a lot of relays and a lot of good times, because with the talent that was there, we had a really great 400 guy there as well. And so we had all the ingredients
for a
really great DMR. And so my freshman year, we won the DMR at Penn Relays, and that was actually a very emotional experience. I didn't realize it at the time. I'd run in Penn Relays in high school, but in college, like at Villanova, Penn Relays is bigger than any event. And there's a lot of stories around it and a lot of almost like magic, you know, that can happen. Like even if you're out of shape or injured, somehow you can pull out a great race. And it was true. It happened all the time. And so my freshman year, I was 800 leg and we won the DMR. And I remember you take a victory lap and there were people in the stands. You could see them. They were like crying and they were, you know, remembering, like, cause Villanova, we had not won the DMR in 20 years.
Wow.
And I think the last time we had won it, Marcus was on the team, our coach was on the team. And so it was a pretty special experience.
That is so cool. So back then, what did a weekly workout look like for you?
Oh, well, when I joined Villanova, Marcus had a whole program that we were working on that was really driven by, his training, his experiences, but also like a lot of heart rate training, a lot of threshold training, it was all based on like max heart rate and stuff like that. So we had heart rate strapped to us for a lot of the days.
That was ahead of its time a little bit, right? This is sort of early 2000s.
Ahead of its time. And honestly, I struggled with it. I don't know if like, you know, the tests that we did early on, it didn't work well. I have a working theory, because like the first max heart rate test we did was on a treadmill. You're hooked up to the mask and everything. And actually I got pretty far into it and I kind of slipped and fell off the treadmill and had to try to jump back on. And, but everything after that is based off of that max heart rate. And I remember a lot of workouts for the first really couple of years I was there, you're trying to follow a percentage of your max heart rate in these workouts. And I was running, you know, these really slow, sort of strange times for workouts. So for a lot of guys, it worked really well. And for me, it didn't quite click. I don't know why.
And does that kind of go back to that high school experience where you used to go out, I'm going for a run, I'm going to go run fast. I'm trying to go faster. So that's what I'll do. I mean, does that sort of simple, pure view of the sport, did it get too technical and too scientific?
Yeah. You know, I'm not a psychologist. So everything I'm about to say is just like my version of history in my head. I was hungry and I, you know, didn't know any better in high school, you know, and sometimes that's to your advantage. And so I just, I ran hard and I had goals and I did whatever I thought I had to do to reach them. And so I never thought I was talented or had, you know, just even that, I don't even really like that word talent, but, you know, you start, so I graduate and now next thing I know, I've got a scholarship. I'm running at a premier university. You know, I'm a miler, I've, you know, placed high at nationals. And, you know, I think maybe at some point I probably did start to think I was talented. You know, I probably did start to believe those things. And so then the question in your head is like, well, why am I no longer improving? Why are things not, you know, why am I not getting any better? And I failed to make the connection for a long time that my work and lifestyle and everything else was directly connected to that. And so you fast forward to the end of my college career where it hadn't gone the way I'd wanted it to. And I felt kind of frustrated about it. Well, then my attitude shifted again. You know, again, I'm thinking like, I'm not talented. I'm not very good. You know, how do I reach, you know, my, you know, any goal that I have. And so it was through sort of hard work. And, you know, after I graduated, my family threw a graduation party, which is very nice of them. My aunts and uncles and everybody came over and everybody gave me a little bit of money. And I had just enough money to buy a plane ticket. And at the time there weren't a whole lot of post-collegiate clubs. It was early 2000s. And, I was fortunate to go be able to join the Nike Farm Team, which was trained out of Stanford University in Palo Alto. And so I got a one-way plane ticket and went out there. And when I got out there, the talent in that team was actually very deep. I mean, you had a variety of guys who had run 338 for 1500. You had, you know, former Olympians, Jonathan Riley in the 5K, and, you know, some great talent. And so those guys, I couldn't finish half the workouts with them, you know, like, so I really didn't think I was very good. And that everything kind of came back all of a sudden, that probably that high school mentality kind of was back alive. And so I just lived that life, you know, and I was trying to train, and I had to get a job to support myself, and, you know, and things sort of worked out. But it was, psychologically, I think that was a big part of it. You know, that belief, almost like, it sounds negative, you know, but there's something there, you know, that like,
yeah,
believing you're not good at something is fuel, you know, versus thinking I'm good at this. Why isn't this working out? It's like talent is, obviously there must be some talent or there's some physical attribute that allows you to run a sub 4 minute mile, but you know, so much of it was psychological, and it took me a while to sort of figure that out.
So then did you wind up making improvements when you're with the Nike Farm Team?
I did. So when I got out there, so just to wrap up the Villanova story, when I graduated from Villanova, I was running a little slower than I'd been running in high school, really by the time I was done. And so you can imagine how that feels to me. And also, you know, my teammates, I was on scholarship. And so that's a spot that could be going to somebody else who's probably more deserving at the time. And yeah, that felt bad, you know, to sum it up. And so when I went out to the Farm Team, I really, you know, the coach out there was Frank Agliano. He used to coach at Georgetown. And Coach Gags, like he was tough, man. It was a different program. At Villanova, I never really ran more than probably 60 miles a week. And running for Gags was, it was kind of trial by fire. You're running anywhere probably from 75 to 90 miles a week, three or four workouts during the week, some pretty serious long runs in there.
Even middle distance guys were doing logging that amount of mileage.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, you know, and maybe not everybody, but a lot of the team was, and you know, some people were getting hurt and some people weren't, and so within a year though of moving out there and training that way, I ended up making the finals at USA's my first year out there in the 1500. And so I went from running slower than I was in high school my senior year to making the finals at at USA's and running a PR in 1500, ran 340 at that time. And so that was, you know, I felt like I was on the right track again.
Very interesting. And then, so that lasted 2 or 3 years with Nike.
Yes. Yeah. So I moved out there in late 2004, right after I graduated, and I was there until 2006, you know, and then met a girl who had joined the farm team as well. And that's how I ended up moving to North Carolina, because she was a UNC grad. We both have family on the East Coast. My family's in New York, her family's in Virginia. And so we were trying to weigh our options, because the farm team in 2006 was sort of disbanding. There was a new team that was forming up in Oregon, and there were some of us that had spots up there. And actually, I was one of the people and the fortunate people who had a spot. It was a pretty sweet deal if you're right out of college, where they're going to pay for housing, and you had a stipend that you could live on. And, wow. You know, Nike was investing some more money in the program. And, but, you know, at that time, I, you know, we just kind of weighed options and decided to make a change. And so moved to North Carolina. And at that time, I didn't really know what I was going to do next. I knew I wanted to keep running. I thought I was going to coach myself. But that's really how we ended up here.
And is that, are you married to her now?
Oh yeah, we're married. We've got four kids.
All right. All right. Cool. Well, I just want to make
dogs.
Sure. I thought that's where you're heading with the story, because yeah. You mentioned your wife went to Carolina. So, all right. But I just want to make sure it wasn't, you know, I wasn't embarrassing you in front of a national audience here of like two different Carolina girls that you dated in the running community. So
no, absolutely all right. Not. Just one. All right. No, Trish and I we're very happily married. So yeah, when we moved here, Trish, she actually introduced me to her college coach, Joe Nesbitt Mabe. Who was a 10K Olympian in 96. And she, I remember thinking when we got here that I was going to coach myself. And so I, you know, and I was putting together the things that worked for me across all the different programs I've been in. And Joan is like, Trish said, you got to meet Joan. And so I met her at a local coffee shop called the Open Eye. And I went in there. I remember meeting Joan and thinking, I thought I was interviewing her, you know, like I was going to potentially pay somebody to coach me. And very quickly, I realized Joan was interviewing me. And she actually asked me, she said, well, you know, for me to coach you, first you need to write an essay and tell me about why you run. And I thought, gosh, like I'm out of college. Like, I gotta write an essay. Like this doesn't feel right to me. But it was surprisingly difficult to write an essay about why I run. And I encourage everybody who's listening, if you haven't done it, to try to put some pen to paper, put some real thought to why you run. And you kind of run into, there's a variety of reasons, and you know, it can be a challenging and interesting and enlightening exercise to go through. But yeah, Joan and I, we started working together, and that first year working with her, I ran 357 miles. She was she had a very different style of coaching and training, by the way. Whereas you know, with Gags, it was very probably Lydiard-ish. You know, and actually Jack Daniels would come out occasionally. Jack Daniels and Coach Gags are good friends. Sure. And he would talk to us very scientifically about the types of training we were doing. Gags might say things like, you know, we're going to mix together strength and speed. And that's how he might describe the program. And Jack would come in and talk about, you know, everything else around it, VO2 max and all that stuff. But Joan, you know, a lot of her inspiration came actually from Mahalia Igloy, who I don't know if you're familiar, if your audience is familiar, but a very different style of training, very interval based. With her, I probably only ran 40 to 50 miles a week, really dropped it down. And the intensity went up a good bit in the workouts. She never repeats workouts during the calendar year. So you only get to do one workout once a year, and it kind of happens on a cycle. So, you know, you only get one chance a year to do a workout. She helped me tremendously with sort of the mental game, and I became more of a professional under her in terms of like my approach and how seriously I took everything. It was great working with her.
Very interesting. And was Trish still running at that point?
Yeah, Trish was still running. She battled, you know, injuries off and on, and so yeah, that was. And now we both are constantly sort of battling injuries as we try to run as we're getting older. But she was still running. We actually formed a club team, like a USATF sponsored or USATF club team. It's called the Carbo Athletics Club. And we got New Balance to participate. And actually the local Fleet Feet store helped participate in it. And so that was great. That helped fund some travel and some gear and things like that for the team members. That was a while ago now.
And so what was your first date, a running date? Well, I guess you met each other on the track or, you know.
Yeah, we met each other on the track. So it's just, you know, and then you see each other sort of compete, and, you know, it's a lot of similar interests. And so we found out we had a lot in common. We're both from really big families. I'm one of 8 kids. She's one of 7 kids. And just the more we got to know each other, the more in common we had. And we're very happily married and in love. So it was kind of magical. It just happened so quick too. Probably a lot of my friends were surprised at how quick it happened, but and then she's just such a tough competitor, and I saw that and she saw that in me. And so, yeah, we just had that connection.
Very cool. So do you remember the first date? Well, I know you remember the first date. Was there, you know, at a certain point you say like, hey, we should have coffee after we run, or?
Oh yeah. The first date is kind of embarrassing, actually. We, she had just moved out there. It might've been her first day there, honestly. And,
smart strategy. Just pounced early before the other dudes could.
Early.
Yeah.
Yeah, her roommate and my roommate at the time were sort of interested in each other. So it kind of turned into a double date. And so her and her friend came over. And I remember she came over and they were, my roommate and I, we might have been wearing similar, we might have been similarly dressed. Trish still jokes around about this. I think we were wearing like blue button-down shirts and a pair of jeans or something. And Trish just came in and she was like, are you guys joking? Like she thought, you know, this is like ridiculous. Like, you know, because, you know, we're like 22, 23 years old all the time. And I went up and changed and I put on I had a bright pink like polo shirt and I popped the collar and I was like, is this better? And so we all went out and, you know, that's that side of me that is a little irreverent. So, but then we had something to talk about. So that was our first date, was me being kind of a jerk, but somehow, you know, it worked out.
Wow, if only the iPhone were around then, you know, you'd have great pictures of the pink pop collar shirt.
Thank goodness. Yeah, no iPhone and not a lot of social media at the time either. So those are both good things in my favor.
Yeah, yeah. And did you both wound up working for Fleet Feet at one point, right? You and Trish?
Yeah, so, well, Trish had worked at Fleet Feet when she was in college. So when she was at UNC undergrad, she worked at the store. Part-time. And so when we moved to North Carolina, it was September, October, 2006. Trish is a Montessori preschool teacher.
Okay.
But moving here in October, there weren't really a lot of teaching jobs. And so she went back to the Fleet Feet store and got a job there. I was taking part-time jobs. Like I was taking part-time work and, temp jobs. And I was having some chronic like knee pain from running. And I remember Trish said, hey, you got to come to the store and get fit for shoes. I'd never been fit for running shoes before in my life.
Really?
Really. I grew up in Plattsburgh, New York, there wasn't a running store.
Sure.
We had a Klein's All Sports and I went in there and, you know, got a pair of Asics running shoes. And, you know, back when I started running and I just didn't know. I thought shoes hurt your feet until you kind of broke them in.
Right.
even to that point, even in my, you know, early 20s, I thought that. And then in college, you know, we were a Nike sponsored school. And so shoes were given to us. And, you know, some of us would go down to the local running store, Bryn Mawr Running Company, and trade them out for different things. But again, I hadn't been fit for shoes. I didn't really know. Living out in California and being on the farm team, again, shoes were given to you. I just kind of wore what I thought kind of fit the best. And
yeah.
So, you know, I took Trish up on her offer. I went to the store. She fit me for a pair of shoes. She told me afterward that I was the worst customer she's ever had. I had a lot of questions and I was very skeptical because she, you know, at Fleet Feet, at a running specialty store, you get taken care of, right? They ask you a lot of questions. They measure your feet. They, you know, bring out a couple pairs of shoes. You try on, you're kind of picking based on comfort. But she also brought out a pair of insoles, a pair of Superfeet insoles. And, you know, I was just doing the math on how much everything cost. And I was thinking I already knew what I needed. And so finally, she just made a deal with me. She said, just put this stuff on, go for a run, come back and tell me how it feels. And it was the first pain-free run I'd had in probably 3 years.
Wow, right away.
Right away. And I was a believer then. And so I was very interested after that. You know, coincidentally, the corporate office for Fleet Feet is based in Chapel Hill in Carrboro, North Carolina. And there was a get together, I think a week after that or 2 weeks after that. And I met a bunch of people who I didn't even realize that it was a franchise or that there were multiple Fleet Feet locations in around the country at the time. And I don't meet a lot of people. I thought everybody, you know, worked at the store, and I found out afterward that it was actually a mix of people who work at the corporate office, people at the store. And I hit it off with a couple of people. And one of the people at the party who we went to this get together, who I really, you know, hit it off with was Joy Pointer, who's actually now our CEO.
Yeah, sure.
And Trish had told me afterwards, she said, "Hey, you should apply to work at the company." And, you know, I don't have a business degree. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I, you know, so I did. I just submitted an application. I think I emailed it to the info@FleetFeet email address, and Joey picked it up. And coincidentally, they needed a little bit of help at the company, pretty small workforce at the time. And they needed somebody to actually like answer the phones and take out the trash. And so Joey hired me for 30 days. That was my start at FleetFeet. So I was very fortunate that happened. It was a happy coincidence. I've been lucky my whole life, really. It's really what it boils down to.
No, that's great. Because I think you were an English major in college, right? So you, no offense, I was a history major. So no offense to us liberal arts majors, but you don't graduate with a lot of practical skills that employers are dying to bring in-house.
That is right. And you know, communication skills, though, you know, that
there
I
you
think
go.
Were beneficial. But yeah, you know, I running was my life. And so that was what I was mostly interested in. I knew at some point I would transition, but I had not given a lot of thought to what that would be. And working at Fleet Feet in those early days was a really amazing experience, because the company was relatively small, which meant that, you know, everybody kind of gets involved in whatever's going on. And I was in a lot of meetings. I got to, you know, participate and learn from everybody in the company. Everybody was a mentor at that time. And when you look at Fleet Feet as an organization, there's at the time there were about 65 locations across the U.S.
Okay.
So I got to know our franchisees, business owners, and you know, the running industry itself is a pretty special place. It attracts people who want to be involved in their community, who want to help other people, and so it's a lot of just really good people. And so I was an avid learner. You know, obviously I like to read and learn, and I just kind of applied that at work, and new opportunities kind of kept coming up. And so over time, you know, I was asked to help and participate in other little ventures that would pop up, and one thing would lead to another. And then that, you know, has turned into a career. So there's some coincidence there, but I fell in love with it. I remember sitting down with the former CEO when I was at the tail end of my running career. And, you know, I told him, I said, "Hey, I love Fleet Feet. I'd like to make a career out of this." And he just said, "Absolutely." You know, it was like, it was that simple, you know? And so it was, it was great.
Well, because it doesn't always work out that way. I remember years ago, I met with the head of marketing at Ironman Triathlons, and he said, "Yeah, for years and years, we had a bunch of tri geeks in here. It's like, oh, you're super passionate about triathlon. Come on in. Yeah, of course you'll be able to figure out, you know, the finance function that we're assigning you to." And he said, over time, you know, we kind of learned as the organization got bigger and worldwide, we realized we needed some real specialists, and triathlon experience in itself was not that important on the list of qualifications. But it sounds like in your case, you were able to, you know, merge your personal passion and some professional aptitude, which doesn't always work out that way, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, because the running background, it's not, you have to transition, you know, from, let's just take being an athlete to being a working professional. They're not the same thing. Right. Being an athlete is, you're so focused on this one thing. And it can be infinitely complex. I mean, there's so many different mm-hmm. things involved in being an athlete. So I don't mean to say it's not difficult or hard, but your working life is, there's a lot more incoming, a lot more variables that get thrown in, and you have to really, you're just trying to transfer the things that made you successful as an athlete, you know, believing yourself, working hard, that sort of stuff, and bring that over to work. And I think the first couple of years I was at Fleet Feet, I was, you know, dabbling in that a little bit and trying to learn, you know, but I didn't really figure it out until afterward, when I really started to commit and started then I became, because I was a student of the sport as an athlete, then I became a student of the sport of business. Hmm. And then I couldn't read enough books. I couldn't learn enough. I couldn't ask enough questions, and just sort of caught on fire in that way. And so the running side in the industry, it's, you know, it comes up once in a while, but it rarely comes up because it's not really, it's definitely not a requirement. And it's not, it's just kind of like an interesting thing. You know, occasionally you run into other people that you ran against in college or who ran in college. And so you have something to talk about, but it doesn't come up a lot. Really, it's, you know, so I talk a lot to people about like self-efficacy and sort of believing in yourself and how that's like something you can carry forward as an athlete into anything you do. Because I think you learn, you know, when you're training, you stretch yourself in different ways and you find out things about yourself that you can only find out when you're in the thick of a very difficult moment, you know, like in a very challenging race where you're, you know, everything is sort of like telling you to stop. Your brain's telling you to stop, stop. Right. Your heart and lungs and your legs are telling you to stop and you got to keep going. You know, that, you know, you learn what you're capable of. And, you know, I've used that. I've had to tap into that in business a ton of times because there's maybe this impossible deadline or impossible task or impossible challenge, whatever it is, and say, well, I'm going to get that done, you know? And that I think comes from that belief that sort of stems back, goes all the way back to running. So I think it does transfer, but it's not as simple. It's not like you just show up and everything's great. I think you have to really work at it.
Well, I just read a blog post earlier this week about problems in business, and you never, you know, let's say you have a big problem that's presented to Fleet View with the pandemic, and you can solve for that problem, but you never solve every problem, right? You know, as soon as you solve that one, three other things are going to pop up, right? That's not a bad thing. That's just sort of the cycle of business life. But I think my guess is that for athlete, not every athlete makes that connection, right? Not every athlete can pull back and say, yeah, okay, yeah, this was a really tough time my sophomore year in college for whatever reason, injuries or, you know, tough teammate situations. And I fought through that one. But it is a slightly different skill set, right? So you would say, yeah, on paper, okay, I want this resilient athlete on my business team, but not everybody makes that connection. So I think that sounds like what you're coaching people toward is a really smart thing to coach people toward, which is that, hey, draw on those reserves. It's not automatic though. Just because you overcame adversity as an athlete doesn't mean you will automatically solve business problems happily and professionally over and over.
Yeah, that's how I think about it, you know, and that it's you have to really apply yourself. And I don't know, I think staying curious and staying sort of humble and having humility in a sense that you never know everything and you never will. And the things you think back, tying it back to running again, I was having this conversation with my oldest son recently where it was the end of his track season and he kind of thought, you know, oh, things are going well. I just want to kind of, I want to bag it. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to compete anymore. And I was like, hey, just as a heads up, you know, the number of times that I felt good on race day and all the training had come together in the right way and the race, you know, worked out the way I wanted to, I think I could probably count the number of times that happened to me my whole career on one hand.
Right.
It rarely works out that way. And so, you know, you have to recognize that. And so that's, you know, you have to understand that, like, things are just never going to be perfect. They're always going to be messy. In the middle of every project is, you know, is chaos. And that's most of your working life. And so I'm not that easily rattled when it comes to things that pop up in the business. Some things do rattle me, but not many. Because I feel like everything's just a challenge you have to solve. And I mean, just think about like one of my rules as an athlete was never miss. That was one of the rules, right? And it didn't mean not to take a day off. Actually, it meant the opposite of that. It meant that of your own volition, don't miss, you know, don't sure. miss a workout, don't miss a training day, because things pop up. You may have a workout planned and the workout may involve you going to the local track and you get to the local track and there's a high school lacrosse game going on. And so what do? You know, and so you have to improvise. And this may sound like common sense, but, you know, there's so many times where that you know, you're just tired and it's like, thinking through what's next is can be kind of hard. And so all of a sudden you don't run that day, or, you know, you go for an easy jog instead, or you start to skip things, and those that can add up. And so how do you improvise? That's, I think, the name of the game. So often in everything that we do and have to do in life and in work.
So I should have done this earlier on, but so for people, probably half of our listeners will be super familiar with Fleet Feet and have one in their neighborhood, right? And it's their go-to local specialty run shop. But there are big chunks of geography in the country where Fleet Feet does not have a physical presence yet. But you've had a remarkable last 18 months. And, you know, there's probably a tiny bit of guilt there, right? A lot of people financially or other health-wise have not done well during the pandemic. But guilt aside, it's been a great 18 months, really, for the sport, obviously not for in-person racing. But I think it's, you know, doing what I do for a living, I think it's great that, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of new runners have entered the market, which is great on so many levels. But you've had set records in revenue and in performance and e-commerce growth. So what have the last 18 months felt like at Fleet Feet?
Yeah, that's it's a great question. Actually, I'm going to answer it and go a little bit further back in time.
Yeah, please.
Fleet Feet was founded in 1976 by two female pioneers at the time, who opened up a running store. That was their passion, what they wanted to do, in Sacramento, California. And, you know, this is like in the running boom, but it was a different time. And so, but their mission and their goal was to help, you know, this community of emerging runners sort of get the right gear, and really have that community and help create that community and foster it over time. That spirit of what began in 1976 has really persisted over time and still is, you know, the mission and vision sort of the company today kind of goes back to that. And Fleet Feet today is 186 locations across the US. It's a running specialty business. If your listeners haven't been to a run specialty store, I highly encourage it. It's a very unique and special experience. I like to say you get to meet a real person who's going to ask you real questions and spend time with you and measure your feet. The business, the things that have changed, though, have been, there's been a couple different running booms over time. The key sort of like footwear manufacturers and suppliers have changed over time. Right. And you fast forward to just before the pandemic, and we were starting to see some pretty healthy growth. Our franchisees and business owners, I mean, they work really hard in building community in every community that they're in helping each individual that comes in their store. I mean, that is the business model. And so in a way, it's a very ground up model, you know, and Fleet Feet as a company, you know, we have to take a lot of cues from what happens in our retail stores and from everybody's working with our customers on the front lines. And that shapes a lot of the programs that we come up with. And a lot of times it's just sharing best practices and what happens in one location with another. And there's that sense of sort of like entrepreneurship, it persists throughout the organization. And that sense of sharing and sort of community is sort of like embedded. And it's very mission-based, you know, selling running shoes is it's kind of mission-based at its heart, because you're helping somebody better themselves, and they're there because that's what they want to do. The business model is pretty solid. And when you think about run specialty in general, it actually has weathered a lot of different storms. Like even you go back to 2008 and the recession, the economic recession, the business actually did not decline during that time. You know, back then it was like, we noticed that maybe people were less likely to take a vacation or, you know, buy a new car or things like that. But they really needed their running shoes. And that was part of how they were, you know, one of the things that they were still willing to spend on. And so you think about the pandemic, and what's happened is there's been a lot of people that were looking for a way to better themselves a little bit. They needed a mental break, an emotional break, and running and walking became like even bigger than they were before. And that was, for a lot of people, maybe their only real outlet. And so the category of running just, you know, it's grown tremendously. And so right now, Fleet Feet is benefiting as a business from that. But really, it just means we get to help more people. We get to help more people who are coming in. And the challenge as a specialty store in any industry is really kind of increasing awareness and making sure people know you exist. We often talk about that we're the best kept secret in town, you know, that the majority of the market doesn't know that we exist. And people who want to buy running shoes in every market we're in, the majority of people don't know who we are, what we do. And so the challenge is, how do you reach them? And that's where, you know, we think about e-commerce or our online business. We've been working really hard to create a better bridge, you know, digitally to in-store. And the last 6 years, I was actually running our e-commerce business up until I took this new role as chief operating officer. And that was always the goal. The number one metric that we were using to measure the health and vitality of the e-commerce business was, are we assisting the in-store growth for the company? And really, it was always trying to answer the question of, are our stores growing? And our entire online business model is actually built on the local community model as well. I mean, we actually revenue share with every local Flea Feet in the country when online sales happen, actually. So, and the majority of all the online sales that happen are coming, they actually get shipped by a local Flea Feet store. They pull from their back stock of inventory. And so it's kind of a local model.
Yeah, no, and sorry to interrupt you, but I think that's a really important point for what you guys do that is pretty different. And you're starting to see some bigger retailers adopt this, not just in running, but across all different categories of retail. But that's pretty unique because you can't, you know, unlike Amazon, you can't undercut your local store prices, for instance. You can't say, oh, we're on, you know, online version only, we're going to knock 30% off, because you can't compete with the stores, right? And then I also think it's a really unique, this distributed inventory. So if I buy a pair of Brooks Glycerins on your site, they're actually going to be delivered from my nearest location, right? And that store gets revenue credit for that. So that's different from 99% of all e-commerce experiences.
That's right. And we built it that way intentionally in, you know, 6 years ago or 7 years ago when we launched e-com in the beginning, it was, we had to answer questions like, how would Flea Feet, or how would a business like Flea Feet, you know, launch e-commerce? Like, how's this going to work? And yeah, I mean, we're really committed to not undercutting our franchisees on price ever. We stay in sync. You know, sometimes things, we slip up, we make a mistake, we accidentally. And so, but our community, people let us know right away, and there's never any hard feelings. I mean, we just quickly correct it. And everybody knows what we're focused on and that, you know, what the mission is, and that we're not going to do that. So, it's initially when we launched, we had 9 of our physical retail locations were shipping products. And now we have 154.
Wow.
Out of 186 are actually like active mini warehouses, really. So it's been interesting because like our average ship times are very, very competitive. I mean, it's about 1.5 days. Sometimes we hear from customers now that get it within 24 hours, and I'm surprised, you know, that we're able to do that. There's benefits. There are challenges with it, you know, because especially right now, you know, having enough people to work in the stores is a challenge. Having enough people, right, you know, helping customers, and they're also the same people who are trying to fulfill online orders, and that business has increased dramatically. And so that is a hardship. And then inventory itself, you know, due to COVID, there's challenges, supply chain issues and factory issues, you know, in China and Vietnam and other places. And so we see that as well. And that really means we might have a little bit less product. And so when that product is available for this growing online business, but also the in-store business, that poses other challenges for the business. That's things that we're always aware of and we're trying to get better at. But there's, you know, there's a never ending list of challenges that are constantly changing in the business.
Well, and to me, I think the from the outside, the biggest, spookiest challenge is that you are competing every hour of every day against the largest retailer in the world, Amazon. So I assume 99.9% of every SKU that you carry, you could also buy on Amazon. And sometimes, cover your ears, listeners, but sometimes you can get them cheaper on Amazon, right? And so, but that's where that helping people and that local community contact, I mean, I couldn't tell you last time I bought a pair of shoes on Amazon because I'm local. I'm very loyal to our local specialty run shops. I feel like, hey, these guys organize Monday night fun runs and a couple of great races every year. And I really appreciate the in-store help. And so, you know, some percentage of your customers, I'm sure, go in, get a custom fitting figure out which exact model and size is perfect for them. And then for the next 3 years, they will buy them online. But I think a big chunk of people keep coming back for that service and that relationship and that community.
It's interesting because, you know, what we see is actually, while the majority of customers are researching products online, and actually with Amazon, you can research and buy. And so people are researching online, but the majority of purchases for running shoes, they happen in physical retail locations.
Interesting.
It may not always be a running specialty store, but they're happening in physical retail locations. You know, one of the challenges for Flea Feed is that the products we carry, the brands we carry, they are available pretty much everywhere else, right? Like big box stores will have the products. Amazon might have it. Now certain brands are not available in some of these other channels of distribution. They might be really focused on running and they don't actually put their products on some of these other channels. And so there is some things you can only find at a specialty store. And there are some things you can only find at a Fleet Feet location. But what I like to think about is that, and this sounds a little strange, but in some ways it's more convenient to buy your, at least your first pair and multiple pairs from your local run specialty store, because so many things change. Even like the shoe you love today, that next version of that shoe might change a little bit. And so getting refit for shoes from time to time, but that initial fit is so important. Going back to my original story of running and getting fit for my first pair of shoes by my future wife, you know, that experience is really important. Like I learned a lot about myself, my feet, and it was like in 30 or 40 minutes, you get a crash course. And so that is a very convenient way to learn about what really works for you. And just you end up buying based on comfort. And so I can't recommend it enough. And I run into people all the time and we end up in conversations about the shoes they're in or if they have any foot pain. And, you know, I start to explain to them what we do. And man, like they go into the store because they, you know, people need it. I'm a big proponent of it. And I think that the local aspect of it and the business itself of fitting people for running shoes is not going to go away. I think the online piece just can't replicate it. Even with the advent of different technologies that are emerging, it's feeling a pair of shoes, trying them on is still going to be key. And so, I think that the future still is very, very bright for running.
No, I agree. And so, you've been very generous with your time. I promise I won't hold you up very much longer, but, I did want to hit on really quickly. So you're a franchise model. So if somebody, I know for sure there are listeners right now who are daydreaming about maybe I should turn my personal passion into my professional passion. So becoming a franchisee of Fleet Feet is a pretty good business deal, right? I mean, so what does that look like? I'm kind of curious if you look at maybe your top quartile of performers, you can make a really nice living as owning a Fleet Feet franchise.
Yeah, I mean, really, what we see is people who it's like a second life, you know, and they're probably having a certain passion for running and business, and they have an appetite for some of the risk involved in owning your own business and being your own boss and entrepreneurship. And you know, when we find, you know, when candidates come through and they're interested in it, you know, we don't sugarcoat anything. We kind of really get to it of like how this is going to work, what the lifestyle is going to be like. We connect them with current franchisees because it's a little bit of a labor of love. You know, like you're going to be in the thick of it from day one. And the model really works best when people are in the community, very active. They love customer service. They really want to help people that are coming in the store. You know, we have a lot of training that goes into helping our staff be, you know, really up to speed and everything. So, but anybody who's interested, you can go to fleepy.com and, you know, down at the foot of the website, you can find links to franchising opportunities. And then we also have another website called franchise.fleepy.com. And we highlight owner stories and a lot of that information. So there's some of the most fun conversations we can have is when people are interested and that's the next step that they want in their life, and we can find hopefully the right market and everything kind of works out. But it's sort of like a family of friends at Fleet Feet, and we have an annual conference every year, and you know, you form really strong connections with everybody in the brand. And I don't know, it's obviously I love it, and I can't speak more favorably about it, but It's a great business opportunity, and it's a real, you know, nice blend of passion and business.
Well, and I know, given what you just said, this is not the way you lead with your marketing to potential franchisees, but I don't know, can you give an idea? Like how much can, if a franchisee does well, how much can he or she make per year?
Oh yeah. I'm not allowed to say that actually. it has to do with like franchising. You have to be careful in what you're allowed to share and say. I can share.
Oh, so it doesn't turn into a late night infomercial kind of thing of.
Yeah. Well, it turns into an earnings claim. And so you have to be careful of that stuff. So yeah, here's what I would say. Actually, I would hedge it the other way. I would say it's probably not a get rich scheme, you know,
okay.
For people who really want to open up like multiple locations. And, you know, if you really want to open up like some fast food locations or something, then Fleeky's probably not the best opportunity for you. But if it's a labor of love and, you know, you're committed to it, then yeah, I mean, the unit economics continue to improve. We're seeing the business continue to grow. The category continues to grow. So there's a lot of opportunity, but yeah, unfortunately I can't share specific numbers.
No, no worries. No worries. Sorry to put you on the spot there, but
okay. That's okay.
All right. Well, cool. Hey, I'm going to hit you with a couple really quick questions that we've hit some of our other podcast guests with. This is the deep window into your soul with these hard hitting journalistic questions. So fasten your seatbelt. Favorite movie of all time?
Ghostbusters.
That's a great answer. No one has said that yet. I love it. What about Ghostbusters resonated with you?
Oh, it's just like prime Bill Murray. He's just one of my favorites. Yeah.
One of that early scene where he's doing like the Rorschach test, right? Where he's like, well, what's
right away, start to finish in that movie. Yep.
So yeah, no, that's excellent. Favorite book.
Oh, favorite book. Oh, I'm really boring. I read so many business books.
That's cool.
I know. I'm trying to think. I kind of have like a hall of fame for books. So I've got a lot of favorite books.
Yeah, that's it.
Favorite. Oh, gosh. You know what? I'm just going to say Good to Great. And the reason I'm saying that is because that's one of the first books that kind of just took me on a journey of reading so many different amazing books about business. And so that's the answer.
I'm with you. It's on the shelf right behind me. You can see the red cover behind me, but it's it's the first kind of business book I read where it wasn't just a miracle story from day one. I mean, it's so much more realistic of most companies struggle or they plateau or it's, yeah, we got an okay thing going, but it's not spectacular. And then how do you ramp it up to the next level? So no, that's a great one. I love it. And then Shoe Dog I'm sure that's probably mandatory reading for everyone at Fleet Feet, read the Nike story, but that, I love that one for your industry. Morning runner, evening runner, midday runner.
Evening runner.
Evening.
And I'm in North Carolina, so it's actually, probably not healthy, but I'll go out at 5 o'clock, 5:30, and go for my run and it's 90 plus degrees outside. And, that's my go-to. I have done a lot of morning runs, you know, sure, in my lifetime. And as you know, if I have to, that's what I'll do, but yeah, I prefer the evening.
Yeah. Say I lived in DC for a while, which is even worse humidity than Chapel Hill. And same thing. I used to love it. 6 o'clock, you'd like lose 5 pounds of sweat weight while you're out there. Probably not healthy, but yeah, something about it. I felt all right to me.
And it's a transition, right? Between like at the end of my workday to the rest of the evening and time with my family. So it feels that way. And I think a lot on the run, you know, and so, you know, sometimes I'll pick one business challenge or one thing I want to think about and just play it on a loop in my head while I'm out there. And that's been very helpful. You know, it's like I feel like I'm making progress, you know, against a lot of things at once.
You may have just answered my next question, but do you run with headphones or not?
I've tried multiple times and I just need to hear, you know, the wind and nature and have no other sound. I mean, for a while I thought, man, if I just start listening to podcasts or audiobooks or something, I could get through another book a week. And I just, I need that sort of the solace in the run.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you. I could probably count on two hands the number of times I've listened to, well, again, I'm undermining our own podcast because a lot of people probably listen to this on the run, but you know, different strokes. Best mentor in your life?
Best mentor in my life. Well, the person I've learned the most from is probably my wife, Trish. Best mentor. I don't know. I've had so many great mentors. It's hard to say. I'm somebody who I'm constantly seeking out a mentor. So I've had, at every turn of my life, I've had somebody that I'm looking to and talking to and reaching out to a lot. So I can't say one person. I would say the person I've learned the most from has been my wife.
I love it. Last one for you. If you could have dinner with one person, one famous person, living or deceased, who would it be?
Oh, I know I should have a quick answer.
No.
I don't really have a person. Actually, here is a very controversial answer. I would say Lance Armstrong. I've always been fascinated by him. Obviously, for reasons I don't like how everything played out, but he'd be somebody I would love to just really talk to, and listen to and have an interesting conversation with. But I'm not a big celebrity person, and so I don't have a list of people, right? Like, I just but I think he'd be interesting.
No, I'm with you. That's a really good choice. No one has said that yet, because he's a pretty complex guy, right? For better or worse, a lot of different layers. And hey, I think he's had a pretty nice, respectable comeback from the worst of his troubles. He's worked really hard at trying to be a good person, help the sport, help the industry. I've listened to a bunch of his podcasts. He's actually a pretty entertaining host and super engaging personality still. I mean, his personality was always bigger than life anyway, from the time he's 15 years old onward, but yeah, good one.
That's right.
Well, very cool, Jason. Thank you so much. We've gone over the promised time, but you're a good sport for putting up with us. And this is a great conversation. And, I think our listeners will geek out on the running part and the life part and the business part. So it's, this is a triple play for our folks.
Well, it flew by. Thank you so much for the invitation, and I'm glad that we were able to talk. So thank you.
All right. When we launch you into even greater celebrity, just remember us little people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Take care. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, David.
All right.
See ya.